I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, in the heart of a Middle East stunned into understanding what Israel and the USA have long had in store for Palestine. Will Donald Trump's national security adviser, Mike Waltz, be fired? Has he already been fired? Saudi Arabia was swift to attack Trump's plan to ethnically cleanse Gaza, even though it was in the middle of the night, Saudi time, when the US president, sitting beside Israel's Netanyahu, sought to de facto destabilize Egypt and Jordan with millions of refugees. As expected, vassal states in Europe with no sovereignty were muted. But Trump's erroneous claim that Saudi Arabia no longer seeks a Palestinian state also angered China, Russia, and NATO member Turkey. This as Trump facilitated Ukraine bombing of Russia, bombed Somalia, and signed an order to approve bombing Iran. All that in a week that arguably saw Trump uprooting the CIA and shelving the globally destructive USAID agency. 30-year veteran Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is in Falls Church, Virginia. He was chief of staff at the US State Department, now led by Marco Rubio, when NATO powers invaded Iraq. Colonel, thanks so much for coming on. Right off the top, I suppose I better ask you, despite all the relief about USAID, what you thought of that press conference in the White House with alleged war criminal Netanyahu that Trump gave, where he outlined a possible ethnic cleansing route for Gaza.
Frankly, I didn't think that I could be in the future stunned by anything the mercurial, bombastic character Donald Trump said, but I was. This is just such a flagrant violation of the rules-based order, if you will, that we fashion, particularly the international law part of it, that it's just stunning, absolutely stunning. I think the special rapporteur, Albanese, said it correctly. If he wanted to break every law possible to be broken, he did.
Except while the UN Special Rapporteur arguably failed to create a ceasefire, and I know I get criticized from the left as if I'm some Trump supporter here, it was Trump that allowed the children of Gaza to sleep for the first time after 15 months without aerial bombardment amidst the genocide. And, of course, some people are kindly looking on this as saying, now Israel can't start up the bombing amidst these different processes of the ceasefire agreement because it's the United States land now.
Well, this wasn't a humanitarian gesture by Trump. This was strictly transactional to get to the Jared Kushner dream of a Gaza with hotels, Trump hotels probably, and other assets that Trump likes featured on the Mediterranean Sea. This had nothing to do with humanitarian instincts or empathy or sympathy even. And now we're seeing the reality of it, I think. The reality of it, however, as a military professional, I have to tell you, is not only risible, it's extremely dangerous.
Well, if it really was Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump's idea, as you imply there, it is risible because there's no way. I mean, you might have to remind our audience what exactly he said as regards he didn't rule out U.S. troops on the ground to guard this perhaps future Trump hotel project in Gaza, but while saying that the 2 million people in Gaza, which somehow became 1.8, 1.6 million, I don't know whether that was an admission that half a million had been wiped out by British, American, European Union armed bombing over the past 15 months, that somehow U.S. troops are going on the ground there?
I go back to Colin Powell's statement to me on a number of occasions throughout about a decade period. Putting U.S. forces on the ground in Levant in a serious proportion, that is to say, not just at Air Force bases and pass-through facilities as we have in Kuwait, but on a serious basis, warfighting-capable basis, would be the greatest mistake the United States could make with regard to the Levant and possibly with regard to its global position, period. Colin Powell was right. You do not, and H.W. Bush actually said this too in the presence of his then Secretary of Defense, Richard Cheney, you do not suck me into that cauldron. I will not put U.S. forces on the ground there to stay because all they will be is a disaster waiting to happen.
Yeah, so I mean, and it would also cost trillions of dollars, and it's not going to happen then. And so
the other huge question, read Dexter Filkin's just released article in the New Yorker magazine. A huge question. where is he going to get these American troops? He's already given Northern Command a warning order to seal the southern border, given three army divisions, at least brigades of two, and a full division with the 10th Mountain, orders to go to the southern border. Those troops could only cover maybe 100 kilometers of that border. There's 3,150 kilometers of that border. Where is he going to get these American soldiers? We don't have a draft. We have a volunteer force that's falling apart even as I speak, as Dexter Filkin's article points out graphically. Where is he going to get these forces? Is he going to hire private contractors? Like I understand right now, and I have video proof of it, apparently, from a person who was walking along with the Palestinians who were euphoric, even though they were passing through the Nazarene quarter into devastation, into a marscape. They were euphoric about going home. And on their flanks were American-hired security contractors making sure the Israelis didn't take advantage of that passage and kill even thousands more. So where are we going to get these forces? Are you going to hire Eric Prince and a bunch of private contractors? This is a disaster waiting to happen, and Donald is fashioning it from the Oval Office.
But haven't you answered yourself? You said he's transactional. It can't happen. The troops aren't going to be there guarding, you know, Trump investments. That the American people won't go for that. So if it is transactional, albeit with the wrong information being provided to him from Mike Waltz, perhaps, because as you say
that
there...
That could be, I understand.
I mean, will he go? Do you think Mike Waltz is gone when he realizes that Waltz, presumably, is the guy telling him Saudi Arabia is fine with no Palestinian state? I mean, it was really very late Middle East time for the Foreign Affairs Department of the Saudi Arabian going, what are you talking about, basically, an immediate response. There's outrage all around here. And Waltz presumably telling him that Palestinians, they don't want to return, they shouldn't return, when, of course, hundreds of thousands have been returning over the past few days to northern Gaza. It's all wrong information he's being fed.
The word is on the street this morning early, about 7 a.m., that Waltz is gone. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's the word on the street.
What, that he's... I mean, and there's a history of national security advisors going quickly. We had John Bolton on the other week, of course, and hope to get Mike Flynn, who was the first one. So that should hopefully signal that Trump reacts very quickly to when he's being made a fool out of?
I would think so. I said earlier, right after the election, that there wouldn't be a single one if they did pass go with the Senate and get confirmed. There wouldn't be a single one of his major cabinet appointees or reasonable facsimiles thereof that lasted 9 months. They'd all be gone. That's Donald Trump.
At least he said Iran was not in a weak position, somehow blaming the Biden administration for that, unlike what, say, Lindsey Graham and bizarre people in your Congress talk about when they, with respect to Iran and the possibility of an invasion. Iran has just signed that Russia deal, just short of military cooperation, but Iran has been showing off new weaponry. That at least looks off the table. It's just going to be greater and greater sanctions, although Trump obviously hasn't been told about BRICS and that, say, where I'm talking to you from, the UAE is now part of a system, a new grouping with Iran.
I think that's the one thing that I would say is fairly assured in my mind, at least, that Trump is against, is a U.S. use of force, real force against Iran. Taking out an occasional Iranian, as he did with the head of the IRGC, is one thing, but taking on Iran is quite another. I think he's been given the full briefing by different people at different times from the Pentagon on how desperate a circumstance that would create for the United States, not just because we're so woefully short of people in our military, but also because our industrial base is woefully inadequate. We've taken some measures to remedy that, but it's going to take a while. It's going to take a couple of years before we even begin to get going on that. So we don't need to be taking on any more substantial commitments, and Iran would be a very substantial commitment, 10 years, $2 or $3 trillion, lots of troops, a conscription process, a draft, in other words, and many young people in America going to Canada and Mexico.
albeit a precedent has been set by Netanyahu, arguably, that you actually just annihilate a place, make it uninhabitable rather than actually occupying it or taking it over. And Trump talks about maximum... he keeps using this phrase, maximum, and then the pretty poor journalists, arguably, especially at that Netanyahu press conference, kind of ask all options on the table. Is he threatening Iran with aerial bombardment?
I don't think there's anything that Trump won't say as a threat, but I find it very difficult to believe from past experience, his first term, for example, that he'd follow through on most of those threats. He is purely transactional. He has no empathy whatsoever and very little sympathy. But I don't think he is ignorant of the consequences of some of the more drastic actions that even he occasionally puts forward, and understands what kind of damage it would do to him and his coterie. So I don't think he's going to do anything egregious in that form. There are too many people around him to at least tell him that he's naked when he vouchsafes some of these things. So I just don't think he's going to do something like that. And I don't think he likes war at all. And I don't think he understands what he's saying sometimes when he talks about things that those of us who are at least somewhat schooled in it know will probably lead to war, will lead to war. He simply doesn't believe that until someone sits down with him with some temerity and courage and tells him, as the Pentagon has done repeatedly about war with Iran.
So he's not Netanyahu's poodle, Miriam Adelson's poodle.
I think Netanyahu is our poodle. I think I've said this a number of times. I think Mearsheimer and Walt are wrong in terms of AIPAC and its influence. There's no question that the Jewish lobby has influence, and significantly on the Congress. But Israel is our poodle. They are doing precisely at various times what we want them to do, and have been doing that since 1948, when they started out as the British poodle to do that. Britain got afoul of the United States fairly quickly. We took over its imperial writ. And ever since then, with increasing frequency and bloodthirstiness, Israel has been doing our job in the Levant.
And isn't that the point, though, that it's so refreshing to have a person like Donald Trump in the White House who says it how it is, rather than us needing WikiLeaks to release a memo of Blinken... No, Jake Sullivan, the previous national security advisor, sending things to Hillary Clinton, telling him Al-Qaeda is on the side of the United States. Trump would tell us. Trump would tell the American people if their tax dollars was paying Al-Qaeda.
Yep. The wrappers are off. The disguise is gone. Donald Trump has exposed it.
Larry Wilkerson, I'll stop you there. More from the former chief of staff of the U.S. State Department after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, former chief of staff at the U.S. State Department. Colonel, we were talking about the refreshing nature of at least someone in the White House being candid. Can Trump force Egypt and Jordan's hand about the 2 million refugees? Egypt and Jordan have previously always done what Washington have told them to. Can he actually do that, even though it'll, of course, destabilize both those countries?
He has a lot of leverage on both Cairo and Amman, more so on Cairo. I understand now, and this is a fairly reliable source, that the Egyptian military would not be paid if it were not for the United States' largesse going to Egypt. I'm sure that is probably even in excess to the 3.6 or 3.7 billion we give them routinely to bribe them to keep the peace treaty with Israel. And for Amman, it's probably not equivalent amounts, but it's equivalent effect. So there's a lot of influence the United States can exercise there, but it only goes so far. I mean, you're talking about the king in Amman, for example, losing control of his country if, you know, even a million of those two plus whatever million Gazans suddenly appeared in Jordan and added to the already 6 or 7 million he has to look after. It'd be an untenable situation for him. So he's going to be forced to make a hard decision, but I suspect he will make it to balance the money with the problem. And that's not going to do anybody any good. It'll be a half solution, if you will.
Yeah, King Abdullah due in Washington to meet Trump on Tuesday. Of course, USAID was a big decision, CIA decisions as well, offering everyone in the CIA all around the world the offer to resign and get 8 months' salary. I suppose I want to get onto Ukraine in a moment. What was your immediate reaction? You might have to remind the audience of some of the egregious things USAID has done over the years. Of course, most recently, the funding of Fauci's laboratory in China regarding gain-of-function COVID research. But you must have known USAID intimately at the State Department under Colin Powell.
Certainly did. Aid was under Andrew Natsios at that time, and I watched the transition and transformation in USAID. It went from an organization of fundamentally bureaucrats, civil service and foreign service, running development programs in various countries in the world in accordance with U.S. express policy, to being a few of those people, very few of those people, managing a horde of private contractors. And that's the USAID of today. So frankly, if Marco Rubio and Donald Trump wanted to change that entirely, I would stand in the street and applaud them. Because what that did was turn USAID into a fountain of complicity with intelligence services and other NGOs and quahog groups, quasi-government groups, whose intent, either known to them or unknown to them because they were infiltrated by the CIA, was to overthrow governments.
How would you write Samantha Power's obituary? She, of course, was an administrator at USAID after being an ambassador at the UN for your country.
I don't think Samantha Power knew the half of what I just said. In fact, there are very few people outside the cognoscenti, as it were, who know what the United States is doing in places like Georgia, where it is now trying to overthrow the Georgia Dream Party, which has a tenuous hold on power and wants to maintain a balance between NATO in one direction and Moscow in the other. They're trying to overthrow that government. They're working on Colin Georgescu in Romania, so he won't get elected. They're trying to cast the election against him because he's threatened to take Romania out of NATO. This is what we're doing today all over that region, trying to recruit allies in this vicious struggle that we are behind in Ukraine to bleed Russia. And we want more allies in doing that, particularly Georgia and Romania and anybody else, Moldova, that we can get to come into the fight with us at their peril. Look at Georgia. Look at what Putin did the last time we tried this with my president, who went to Tbilisi and stood beside then-President Saakashvili and said Georgia would be a member of NATO in the very near future. Putin invaded Abkhazia and South Ossetia, and he still has titular control over those. Next time, he'll go all the way to Tbilisi.
Yeah, there were referendums there, of course, as the Russians say. I think you're crediting too much ignorance to Samantha Power. I think on Going Underground, we've been covering USAID massively in the same vein as National Endowment for Democracy. Of course, you're intimating there what USAID did in 2014 with Victoria Nuland and the Maidan coup. But, I mean, this is great, isn't it? I mean, National Endowment for Democracy, you can remind our audience what these organizations have been doing as regards not democracy promotion, reducing democracy. Meanwhile,
it's the new arm of the CIA. They're the new arm of the CIA, very sophisticated arm of the CIA. Sometimes they know they are. And there have been objections from time to time from professionals within the groups. But most of the time they don't know they are because they've been infiltrated. And sometimes they don't even have to be humans that infiltrate. It's just the policies and the money that infiltrates and the objectives that flow therefrom. And so they become an arm of the CIA.
I mean, clearly Fox News and the like that Donald Trump watches is concentrating on the woke ideology elements. But it's obvious that when Elon Musk turned open the books, he was shocked at the amount of money. Do the American people realize the scale of the money while their own infrastructure and bridges and basic civilian urban architecture is corroding? Understand how much money they're sending overseas to destroy democracy and destabilize countries?
The majority of the American people, particularly the 77 million that voted for Donald Trump and the 90 million apparently that didn't vote at all, or what I would call, with regard to the maintenance of their country and their republic and their security, ultimately, brain dead. That ranges the gamut from they don't give a damn to they haven't the knowledge nor the education to give a damn. And we're in trouble because of that. We have a very, very uneducated public, probably the most uneducated public in the OECD countries, in the developed countries, period. And that contributes mightily to the ability of people like Elon Musk, J.D. Vance, Peter Thiel, and Peter Thiel now talking about taking back South Africa for white people. It contributes mightily to their ability to put things over on the American people and to do things that later, when they're revealed to the light of day, seem absolutely abominable. But even then, the American people don't seem to have a whole lot of objections, as long as it doesn't redound personally to their inability to watch Taylor Swift or an NFL football game or whatever else might titillate them. That's what they're really interested in. And I'm not saying that because I'm mad at the American people. I'm saying that because it's a reality. It's a stark reality. We have not taken care of our democracy. We aren't now taking care of our democracy. And you pay for that. You pay for that.
Well, Trump got the popular vote, in fairness to the American people. But then Trump also, while trying to annihilate the USAID, started talking about the need to get Ukraine's rare earth metals in a similar vein to real estate in Gaza. Does that mean that there's a quid pro quo? Because, I mean, I know we're both laughing about that, but it's been a lethal week for Russia. He's been attacking.
Well, Lindsey Graham got to him.
What's that?
Lindsey Graham got to him. It's all those critical minerals. You see what's happening in Central Africa right now? These people are killing each other over these critical minerals because anybody will buy them from them and pay them top price. So it's not gold or silver or any of those things that the Belgians ripped up Central Africa over. It's now critical minerals. And these critical minerals are fundamentally, not totally, but fundamentally, they're in the eastern part of Ukraine, which Russia now invests. So you got a problem, Donald, if you want to stop the Ukrainian war and you want those critical minerals at the same time, unless you can talk Putin, and this would be smart. This is the transactional president. You get on a plane, you go to Moscow, you sit down with Putin, you work out a deal, and in that deal, you work out some provisions for you're getting your share of the critical minerals from there, and you don't kill anybody, and you stop the war. Pretty smart president would do that, but I don't know if we have a pretty smart president.
I mean, over the dead bodies of the scale of destruction in Ukraine, it's unbelievable that such a transactional policy could be even thought about. But there's no doubt Trump right now, whether he knows it or not, through the military, you're a 30-year military veteran yourself, the United States has been facilitating, what, an assassination in Russia, killing, attack drones into Russia. It's going on. It's still going on.
Now Trump apparently has signed an executive order. I heard this morning, I haven't seen the executive order, but signed an executive order that tells his posterity, if Iran assassinates him, to bomb Iran. You can't make this stuff up. A Hollywood director would throw you out of his room.
That's what he said at the press conference, that the whole of Iran would be presumably nuclear bombed if he was assassinated, which presumably would only be part of an Iranian policy because he's not allowing Iran to have nuclear weapons that Iran anyway says they don't want, thus ensuring the hardliners in Tehran to say we do want nuclear weapons.
Well, I watch Javad Zarif, who's one of the few people in the Iranian hierarchy now that I listen to and pay attention to, at the Davos Forum when he was being interviewed. I think it was by Fareed Zakaria. And if you read between the lines of what Zarif said, he was saying, we'll do a deal. Come on, President Trump, we'll do a deal. We'll give you the deal of the century. We'll give you a deal that doesn't have a 25-year sunset. We'll give you a deal where we will at least admit to talking about other issues like our ballistic missiles and so forth. We'll give you a deal. Let's do a deal. And then you can go back to Saudi Arabia and you can say, you've got a deal. Iran is not going to be a nuclear power. I assure you the deal will work. And we can go ahead with the elongated, extended, and much more expensive Abraham Accords that Mohammed bin Salman has in mind. That's at the bottom of some of this that Trump is talking about with regard to Gaza. But the Saudis are not going to go along with that, and he's just walked right into a buzzsaw if he thinks they are.
Yeah, and the Iranian government, though, seemingly desperate for this deal because they're separating Palestine from the a new JCPOA nuclear deal. But just finally, perhaps, to the most serious element of world policy, nuclear disarmament, apart from all these transactional, bizarre, albeit dangerous conflicts, can we expect the most important element between Putin and Trump will be the resumption of some kind of START treaty, some kind of treaty to restore nuclear arms reduction to make all our lives safer?
Certainly should be. And if I did make that trip to Moscow, I'll sit down with Putin. And by the way, I'd go by Kyiv and wave at Zelensky and hope that when I flew back and came over Kyiv, he would have been assassinated. Anyway, I would say to Putin, oh, by the way, we're through with this deal pretty much now. We need to talk about not just a bilateral treaty in this nuclear arms business, but a multilateral treaty. You drag North Korea in and I'll drag Israel in. We need all nine nuclear weapons owning states to be in this multilateral treaty regime that you and I are going to forge and take the credit for. Oh, yeah, we can run over to Beijing and give Xi Jinping a little bit of credit for it, too, because we need him also. But let's forge a new treaty environment that is, you know, pretty robust and will work most of the time, at least, and hope the time it doesn't work is not the end of the world. And let's get a handle on these most dangerous weapons, which, by the way, you and I possess about 10,000 of. That would be a real historical achievement and a marker for his presidency. I hope he would think that way about it, but I don't know, because I don't think his advisors, any of them, think that way.
Tulsi Gabbard?
She could be an exception. You're right. She could be an exception.
Colonel Larry Wilkerson, thank you.
Surely.
That's it for the show. We'll be returning to Gaza on Monday to further explore the reverberations of US-UK EU armed genocide, talking to Peter Beinart about his book Being Jewish After the Destruction of Gaza, A Reckoning. Until then, keep in touch by all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.